Thanks for tuning into the podcast. Before we start the show, I want to let you know something. My latest novel, Personal Fable, is free for the next few days. So if you're hearing this ad, it's currently free if you're a Kindle user. So just look it up on your Kindle. If you don't have a Kindle, you can even get one of those for free by getting the free Kindle app on your phone. And then head over, get Personal Fable, have a read, and if you love it, leave a review. And I hope you love the story. Now, let's get on with the podcast. P.S. The promotion runs the 11th, 12th, and 13th of March. Welcome back to the Hemingway list. Did I just say welcome or welcome? Welcome? Welcome. Back to the Hemingway list. Book 2, Chapter 12 of The Red and the Black is the thing that we're talking about. We get a little Matilda insight here. How do you like our newest character? Swim, said the mama fish. He said, in regard to Matilda, Simone de Beauvoir was an admirer of Stendhal's writing. To quote from her book, The Second Sex, he, Stendhal, undertook something that no other novelist, I think, has ever done. He projected himself into a female character. She also included this passage from Stendhal's other best-known work, The Charterhouse of Parma, the day when it will be possible for the woman to love in her strength and not in her weakness, not to escape but to find herself, not out of resignation but to affirm herself. Love will become for her, as for man, the source of life and not a mortal danger. Stendhal is also highly regarded for the accurate analysis of his character's psychology. I think he has done a splendid job of that, i.e. giving us an understanding of Matilda. However, her crushing on Julian wants me to shake her until her teeth rattle. I think Stendhal is a romantic at heart, even if he is writing realism. Here is an interesting article about Stendhal and his views of love, no spoilers. I'm not going to go into the article, but that's a good comment. Altreet said, I remember reading Beauvoir believed Stendhal to be a tender friend to women. So far I agree, and I do like his depiction of women. It doesn't feel sexist, though of course they deal with sexism and are impacted by it. They seem like fully realised people. Emma in Madame Bovary didn't feel sexist exactly, but despite Flaubert's attempts to raise gender issues, Emma also didn't seem to be all that realistic or a complete character from my perspective. Stendhal seems to be saying less about gender explicitly than Flaubert did, but I think his female characters are more realistic and believable, and so he actually accomplishes more. He creates truer stories and characters where women are concerned. Whereas Flaubert seemed sympathetic towards women, Stendhal doesn't need to, he just sees them as people. Jan Brunt said, this book might be my favourite of the Hemingway list so far. Also enjoyed the short stories a lot. It feels light years ahead of its time, while still giving us a lively glimpse into Restoration-era France. Mortal Danger really sums up a lot of the love affairs we've seen so far in the list, especially for the ladies. I also gave you the schmoop summary of the chapter, which goes like this. Matilda praises Julian in front of her brother and Croisenois, the guy who wants to marry her. They tell her to be careful, since people like Julian would have them all killed if they had their way. Pretty soon, all the young men around the de la Mole house band together to destroy Matilda's opinion of Julian. One day, Julian follows Matilda and the group of young men into the garden and hears Matilda passionately defending him. Now he knows there must be something between them. All right. And that's that. That's that chapter discussed. Let's move on. Today's chapter is a bit of a longer one. It's called A Plot. A Plot, Chapter 13. Desultory remarks, meetings brought about by chance, are transformed into the strongest possible proofs in the eyes of a man of imagination if he has some fire in his heart. Schiller. The next day, he surprised Norbert and his sister talking about him again. As he appeared, a dead silence fell, just like yesterday. His suspicions overflowed. Do these charming young people scheme to make a fool of me? It must be confessed that is much more likely, much more natural, than Mademoiselle de la Mole's supposed passion for a poor devil of a secretary. In the first place, do people like these have passions? Mystification is their forte. They are jealous of my poor little superiority with words. Being jealous is always one of their weaknesses. Under this hypothesis, everything becomes clear. Mademoiselle de la Mole wants to persuade me that she favours me simply so as to offer me as an amusement for her suitor. The cruel suspicion completely altered Julian's moral standpoint. It met with a germ of love in his heart that it had no difficulty in destroying. This love was based solely off Matilda's rare beauty, or rather, on her regal manners and wonderful dress style. In such things, Julian was still no more than a parvenu. A pretty society woman is this phenomenon, we are assured, that most amazes an intellectual gifted peasant when he rises into its upper ranks. It certainly wasn't Matilda's character Julian had been dreaming of those preceding days. He had sense enough to realize that he knew nothing whatsoever of her character. All of what he saw might well be only a surface. For instance, Matilda would not have missed Mass on Sunday for anyone in the world. She accompanied her mother to church almost every day. If some rash guest in the salon of the Hotel de la Mole forgot where he was and allowed himself even the remotest allusion to a satirical remark against the real or supposed interests of throne and altar. Sorry, one moment. Matilda instantly assumed an icy seriousness. Her look, so piercing, took on all the impenetrable hauteur of an old family portrait. Yet Julian was sure that she always kept two or three of Voltaire's most free-thinking works in her room. He himself often took a few volumes from the fine edition with the splendid binding. He concealed their absence by separating each volume a little from its neighbour. But it wasn't long before he realised that someone else read Voltaire too. He employed a trick from the seminary and placed horse hairs across those volumes he supposed might interest Mademoiselle de la Mole. They went missing for weeks at a time. Madame de la Mole, exasperated with this book, with his bookseller, Monsieur de la Mole, exasperated with his bookseller, who kept on sending him the bogus memoirs, commissioned Julian to buy anything new that was at all stimulating or outrageous. But to prevent any toxic effects seeping through to the household, the secretary was instructed to put them in a little bookcase in the Marquis's own chamber. He soon became certain that these new books had only to be hostile to the interests of throne and altar for them to not be long in disappearing. It definitely wasn't Norbert who was reading them. Overestimating the importance of this, Julian credited Mademoiselle de la Mole with duplicity worthy of the Machiavel. Such imputed wickedness was an attraction in his eyes, almost the only charm of character she had for him. Boredom with hypocrisy and virtuousness discourses drove him to this extremity. He was working his own imagination up rather than being carried away by love. It was after losing himself in dreams of Mademoiselle de la Mole's elegant figure, of the wonderfully fine taste of her clothing, the whiteness of her hands, the beauty of her arms, the disinvolture manifest in all her movements, that he found himself in love. Then, to complete the spell, he thought of her as a Catherine de' Medici. Nothing was too deep or too wicked for the character he gave her. It was the ideal that he had admired in his youth, of Mazon, of Frilliere, of Castandide. It was for him, in short, the ideal of Paris. He was there. Has there ever been anything more absurd than a belief in the profundity or the wickedness of a Parisian character? It is quite impossible that this trio are making a fool of me, he thought, and one would have understood little indeed of his character if one could not already imagine the sombre and chill expression his looks then took on in response to Matilda's. Bitter irony rebuffed the friendly assurances that an astonished Mademoiselle de la Mole dared twice or thrice to offer him. Piqued by this sudden strangeness, the young girl's heart, naturally cold, bored, and attuned to intellect, became as passionate as it was in her nature to be. But there was also much pride in Matilda's character, and the birth of an emotion that would make all her happiness depend on another was accompanied in her by a somber sadness. Julian had already learned enough since he had come to Paris to be able to discern that this was not the dried-up sadness of ennui. Instead of being eager for evening parties, for shows, and all manner of distractions, as she had been before, she now avoided them. Music sung by French singers bored Matilda to death, yet Julian, who had made it his duty to wait at the exit of society from the opera, noticed that she had herself taken there as often as possible. He thought he discerned that she had lost a little of that perfect poise that shone in all her doings. Sometimes she replied to her friends with witticisms rendered outrageous by their biting force. It seemed to him that she was particularly down on the Marquise de Croisenois. That young man must be madly in love with money not to drop the girl right away, however rich she might be, thought Julian. And as for himself, offended at outrages offered to masculine dignity, he redoubled his coldness towards her. Often he went so far as to answer her in a way that was scarcely even polite. But however resolute he was in avoiding being beguiled by Matilda's display of interest, on certain days there were so marked that, the scales beginning to fall from his eyes, Julian found her so attractive as for it to be at times embarrassing. The skill and the persistence of these young society people will end up the triumphing over my small fund of experience, he said to himself. It is time to depart and put a stop to all of this. The Marquise had just charged him with the administration of a number of small estates and houses he owned in the lower Languedoc. A journey there was necessary. Monsieur de la Mole reluctantly consented to it, save in matters of his high ambitions. Julian had become his second self. When all is said and done, they haven't managed to trap me, said Julian to himself as he prepared for his departure. Whether the jokes Mademoiselle de la Mole makes to these gentlemen are genuine or simply designed to give me confidence, still, I have amused myself with them. If there is no conspiracy against the carpenter's son, then Mademoiselle de la Mole is incomprehensible, but to the Marquise de Croisenois at least as much as to me. Yesterday, for example, her bad temper was certainly not real. Her bad temper was certainly real, and I had the pleasure of seeing a young man who is as noble and as rich as I am penniless and plebeian bucked in my favour. That's the finest of my triumphs. It will cheer me up as I speed in my post-chase through the plains of the Languedoc. He had kept his departure secret, but Matilda knew better than he that he was leaving Paris the next day, and leaving for a long time. She resorted to a terrible headache, made much worse by the stuffy air in the salon. She walked much in the garden, and there her bitter wit so harried Norbert, the Marquise de Croisenois, Calus, Luz, and some other young men who had dined at the Hotel de la Mole, that she compelled them to leave. She gazed at Julian strangely. This look of hers is perhaps part of some play-acting, thought Julian, but this quick breathing, all this emotion, bah, he said to himself, who am I to judge all these things? I am dealing with one of the most sublime and subtle women in Paris. That quick breathing which was just about to move me, she will have studied it from Leontine Fay, whom she admires so much. They had been left alone. The conversation most patently languished. No, Julian feels nothing for me, said Matilda to herself, genuinely miserable. As he was taking leave of her, she gripped his arm hard. This evening you will get a letter from me, she said in a voice so altered as to be unrecognizable. The circumstance quite suddenly moved Julian. My father, she continued, has a proper estimate of the services you render him. You must not leave tomorrow. Find an excuse, and she departed at a run. Her figure was charming. It would be impossible to have a prettier foot, and she ran with a grace that enchanted Julian. But can you guess what his second thought was after she had suddenly disappeared? He was offended at the imperative tone with which she had brought out the phrase, you must Louis XV, too, at the moment of his death, was deeply annoyed at the phrase "you must," clumsily used by his leading physician, and Julian XV was no parvenu. An hour later, a footman handed a letter to Julian. It was quite simply a declaration of love. "There's not too much affectation of manner," said Julian to himself, attempting through literary criticism to contain the joy that rucked his cheeks and forced him to laugh in spite of himself. "At last, me," he suddenly cried, his feelings being too strong to be contained. "Me, a poor peasant, to have here a declaration of love from a great lady. And for me, that really isn't too bad," he added, controlling his jubilation as much as he could. "I have managed to maintain my proper dignity. I have never said I loved her." He started to study the shape of the handwriting. Mademoiselle de la Mole had a fine, small, English-style hand. He needed to have some physical occupation to distract himself from a joy that verged on delirium. "Your departure obliges me to speak. It would be beyond my capability to see you no more." A thought now struck Julian like a revelation, interrupting his examination of Matilda's letter and redoubling his joy. "I have got the better of the Marquise de Croisenois," he cried. "I, who say only serious things, and he so handsome. He has moustaches and a charming uniform. He always finds something to talk about, timed just right, some witty or subtle remark." Julian experienced a spasm of delight. He wandered at random in the garden, ecstatic with happiness. Later he went up to his office and had himself announced to the Marquise de la Mole, who luckily had not yet gone out. He easily demonstrated to him, showing him some papers stamped as from Normandy, that the care of the Norman lawsuits obliged him to put off his departure to the Languedoc. "I am very pleased you are not going," said the Marquise. When they had finished talking of business, "I like seeing you here." Julian went out. This remark made him uncomfortable. "And as for me, I am about to seduce his daughter, and maybe make her marriage to the Marquise de Croisenois. The delight of his fortune, of his future, sorry, impossible. If he doesn't get a dukedom, at least his daughter would have a tabaret." It came to him that he might leave the Languedoc in spite of Matilda's letter, in spite of the explanation given to the Marquise. This flash of virtue evaporated very quickly. "How good I am being," he said to himself, "for me, a pleb, to take the pity on a family of this rank. Me, whom the Duc de Chulnez labels a domestic. How does the Marquise make his vast fortune bigger? By selling his stocks, when he learns of a chateau that might be the semblance of a coup d'état tomorrow. And for me, thrown down by hard-hearted Providence into the lowest rank, I, to whom a noble heart has been given, and not even 1,000 francs in income, that is to say, not enough for bread, literally not enough for bread, I to refuse an offered pleasure, a clear spring sent to quench my thirst in this burning desert of mediocrity that I cross so painfully, by God, not so stupid, for each for himself in this desert of egotism that men call life." And he recalled that many disdainful stares fixed on him by Madame de la Mole, and above all those ladies, her friends. The pleasure of triumphing over the Marquise de Croisenois completed the rout of his dim recollection of virtue. How I'd like him to lose his temper, said Julian. With what assurance! I'd give him a thrust of a rapier now. And he made the gesture of a thrust in a second position. Before this I was a little clerk, basely exploiting my little portion of courage. Since this letter I am his equal. Yes, said he, with tremendous relish, and bringing his words out with deliberation. Our merits, the Marquise and mine, have been weighed in the balance, and the poor carpenter from the Jura has prevailed. Good, he cried to himself, I have found the key to my answer there. Don't go and think, Mademoiselle de la Mole, that I have forgotten my position in life. I will make you understand, and really feel that it is for the carpenter's son that you are deceiving a descendant of the celebrated Guy de Croisenois, who followed St. Louis on a crusade. Julian could not contain his joy. He was obliged to go down into the garden. His room, into which he had locked himself, seemed too narrow for him to breathe. Me, a poor Jura peasant, he repeated to himself constantly. Me, condemned to always wear this dreary black costume. Alas, 20 years ago I would have been in a uniform like them. Then a man like me was either dead or a general at 36. The letter, which he gripped tightly in his hand, endowed him with the figure and stance of a hero. Nowadays, it is true, encased in that black costume, a man may have 100,000 francs a year by the age of 40, and a blue riband, like Monsieur, the Bishop of the Beauvais. Well, good, he said to himself, laughing like Mephistopheles. I am cleverer than they are. I know how to choose the uniform of my century. And he felt his ambition and his affection for the ecclesiastical habit increase vastly. How many cardinals who have been baser born than me have been in government? My compatriot Granville, for example. Little by little, Julian's agitation calmed down, prudence resurfaced. Like his master, Tartuffe, whose role he knew by heart, he said to himself, I may see in these words a plain pretense. I will put no trust in these flattering remarks until a few of her favours, for whom I rapine, arrive to confirm what they tell me is mine. Trafu 4.5. Tartuffe was also ruined by a woman, and he was as good as the next man. My answer may perhaps be shown around, for which we will find this redress, he went on, enunciating his words slowly and in accents of contained ferocity. We will begin with the liveliest phrases from the sublime Matilda's letter. Yes, but some of Monsieur de Cruzenas' footmen might jump on me and grab the original. No, I am well armed, and I am in the habit, as they know, of firing on footmen. Very well. One of the men is brave. He hurls himself on me. He has been promised 100 napoleons. I kill him or wound him. That's fine. It is just what they are looking for. They chuck me in a prison, completely within the law. I appear in the police courts, and they send me with perfect justice to the and equity on the part of the judges to keep company in Poissy with Monsieurs Fontaine and Magalon. There I sleep, higgledy-piggledy with 400 beggars, and I should pity these people, he cried, getting up impetuously. Have they any pity for the Third Estate when they get hold of them? This thought was the last gasp of that gratitude to Monsieur de la Mole, which had, in spite of himself, been nagging at him till then. Softly, softly, gentle sirs, I see this little Machiavellian ploy. Abe Mazon and Monsieur Castandi at the seminary could not have done better. You pinch the letter of provocation from me, and I become the second volume to Colonel Caron at Colmar. But hold on a moment, gentlemen, I am going to send the fatal letter in a well-sealed packet to Monsieur the Abbé Pirard to secure it for me. There's an honest man, a Jansenist, and as such not to be tempted by financial reward. Yes, but he opens letters. It's Fouque I must send it to. It must be confessed that Julian's look was terrible, his physiognomy hideous, he breathed unalloyed wickedness. He was the miserable individual at war with all society. To arms, cried Julian, and he cleared the flight of steps at the front of the hotel in a single bound. He went into a letter writer's booth at the corner of the street, frightening him. Copy this, he said, handing him Mademoiselle de la Mole's letter. While the writer was working on it, he himself wrote to Fouque. He begged him to hold a precious security for him, but, said he, breaking off, the secret bureau at the post office will open my letter and give you what you are looking for. No, gentlemen, he went to buy an enormous Bible at the Protestant bookseller, hid Matilda's letter very neatly in its covers, had it all wrapped up, and so off went his parcel by the post diligence, addressed to one of Fouque's employees, whose name no one in Paris knew. This done, he returned joyful and brisk to the Hotel de la Mole. Now for us, he cried, locking his door and throwing off his coat. Very well, Mademoiselle, he wrote to Matilda. So it is Mademoiselle de la Mole who, by means of Arsene, her father's servant, has had conveyed a most seductive letter to a poor carpenter from Jura, doubtless to play upon his simplicity, and he transcribed the most striking phrases from the letter he had just received. His own letter would have done honour to the diplomatic caution of Monsieur le Chevalier de Beauvoir. It was not yet 10 o'clock. Julian, intoxicated by happiness and a feeling of his own power, so novel a feeling for this poor devil, proceeded to the Italian opera. He heard his friend Geronimo Singh music had never exalted him to such a level. He was a god. All right, there we go. Another chapter down. Julian's quite happy with himself. Have your say over at the subreddit. Thank you very much for listening, and I will see you tomorrow.